Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, this Saturday, May 6, 2017, and welcome to another family discussion here on Blog Talk Radio. Our weekly show is titled Booker T. Washington Speaks. I am Haleem Mustafa, co-host of Booker T. Washington Speaks, supporting Dr. Marsha Washington Cavanis, our honorable and distinguished host and moderator of this weekly broadcast. For those not familiar with his legacy, he is a great senior. He's a senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington and author of a powerful book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. If you haven't done so, I recommend that you purchase a copy for yourself and others who you'd like to educate on the topic, title topic. Again, I am Haleem Mustafa, your co-host, joining you today from the newly gentrified city of East Palo Alto, California. Today, we have another lively family discussion on a serious subject we all should be concerned about. Tonight's topic, why have African Americans departed from the Black Nation Building agenda promoted by the Honorable Marcus Garvey, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and secretly the Honorable Booker T. Washington? As with the tradition of all of our shows, we begin with a prayer, and bear with me, please. With the name of God, most gracious, most merciful, praise be to God, cherisher and sustainer of the worlds, most gracious, most merciful, master of the day of judgment. Thee alone do we worship, and thy aid do we seek. Show us a straight way, the way of those who thou hast bestowed thy grace, those whose portion is not wrath, and who go not astray. Amen. So again, I am Haleem Mustafa, your co-host. And I am here supporting the leadership of Dr. Marshall Washington Cavanis And so without further ado, I'd like to bring him on. And here he is. Sir, are you on the air? If not, I'll continue. I want to say certainly tonight's topic, like with all topics, are really something that are going to be a continuum because there are really a lot of interest from people. And certainly as people get online here, they have option to talk, have option to just listen. We do ask you in terms of your talking that you don't filibuster the program. We want to give everyone a chance to speak because we want to make them understand. This is a family gathering as we sit around our what we call a virtual family room and have a discussion about family business. In this case, family business as African Americans coming back to ourselves out of the condition of slavery and figuring out where we go from here. So that is certainly a topic that we are doing, and we have other topics we have addressed. And so I want to, again, welcome you all to this show, which is on this date. We have May 6, 2017, and we actually are, in those of you who have a Spanish ancestry, which I do, we are in the celebration of not only just being alive as human beings, but with the celebration of Cinco de Mayo. So Cinco de Mayo, enjoy the day. Dr. Washington, are you available, sir?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Hello. So, okay, real good. Well, again, I want to echo what our brother Halim Mustafa just said, welcoming you to our weekly show, which is designed to be a virtual family room where we as an African-American family or African-American community can voice our opinions and our thoughts and our expressions and feelings about things that concern our African-American community here in the United States. And I am Marshall Washington Cabinet Sibuie, and as he said, I am the senior male descendant of the Honorable Booker T. Washington, the African-American visionary that founded the famous Tuskegee Institute, now called Tuskegee University, in Alabama. He was also an African-American leader, and he was actually a world leader. He was invited to confer with kings and queens about how to help the African people rise up from a condition that wasn't the highest form that they could achieve, because they had been actually stripped in many ways of their historic supremacy and reduced to the level of being colonial servants of white Europe. But the Europeans, realizing that they cannot afford to keep colonial armies in Africa, and they could not afford to continue to carry Africa on their back, they were seeking a way to release Africa to stand up on their own two feet. And so they saw that Booker T. Washington was doing that, exactly that, in America with the Africans in America. He's teaching our people to stand up on our own two feet. And so consequently, they asked for his help, for his advice to help the Africans to do the same thing. So we're honored to be here tonight to discuss an important topic concerning the rise of African Americans to become a self-sustaining, independent people within the nation of the United States. And so the topic this evening really concerns the African-American Muslims, but it has an effect actually on all people of all faiths, especially African-American people. The topic is, why have many African-American Muslims departed from the Black Nation Building Agenda, promoted by the Honorable Marcus Garvey and later the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who was a disciple of Marcus Garvey, as well as Noble Drew Ali, and also promoted secretly by the Honorable Booker T. Washington? So we'll repeat that so you can think about that. Why have many African American Muslims departed from the Black Nation Building Agenda, promoted by the Honorable Marcus Garvey and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and secretly by the Honorable Booker T. Washington. I just want to make some brief comments about that, and then I'll turn the mic over. I see we have several guests, and we're certainly looking forward to hearing what they have to say. I want to read from my book, which our brother Ali Mustafa, Dr. Ali Mustafa, the modern day achiever, movement leader, and the doctor of self-esteem. And he mentioned that I'm the author of a book, and it is entitled Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. It was originally published in 2015, and now there's a special edition, a revision, that is in the process of being published and hopefully will be out by the end of this month. But we have a draft copy here with us, and I want to read from it. The book says this. I believe, this is your host, Marshall Washington Cabinet Sibui, speaking, but I'm actually reflecting something that others have said. But I believe that the time has come that African Americans should accept full responsibility for our successes and our failures, individually and collectively. Let me repeat that. I believe that the time has come that African Americans should accept full responsibility for our successes and our failures, individually and collectively. And I continue, as Imam or Minister Wallace D. Muhammad stated in his book, An African American Genesis, and of course we know Genesis means a beginning, we need to step back from the white man and say, look, you have led us as far as you can take us. Now we are going to build our own ideology. Now we are going to build a philosophy of life for our own people, and you cannot help us any longer. That is, in terms of building a philosophy of life for us, of course they can help us economically and maybe in other ways, but not in terms of giving us a philosophy of life. So the Imam Muhammad says, therefore, stand aside and watch us do it, and if we want or need you, we will call on you. And I go on to say, if our people follow this kind of realistic and sane rather than emotion-based guidance, we will throw off the shackles of victimization and the entitlement mentality that keeps us in virtual slavery, dependent on the descendants of our former slave masters. And I'll finish in just a second. As noted by Dr. Charles Horn, a PhD who served as a chapter president of the National Black Chamber of Commerce, and I quote from him, we must embrace an attitude of mental wealth, to focus collectively on the commercialization of our black communities and create an atmosphere of self-sufficiency, unquote. And then I go on and I say, is that not what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad meant when he promoted black-owned businesses under the slogan of Do for Self? African Americans are now living at another crossroads, similar to the crossroads that we faced at the end of chattel slavery. At that time, we had no guidance on how to become self-sufficient because without the ability to read, we could not study books on how the white people had made themselves collectively wealthy. So we'll stop right there and we'll return to some other writings of the prominent spokespersons for economic self-sufficiency for black people later. But at this time, we want to welcome our guests that we see. I see we have a guest from the 779 area code whose last two digits are 55. We want to go ahead and turn the mic over to you and let you say what's on your mind. And then afterwards, we have another guest from the 410 area code. The last two digits are 62. So we'll let the 779 area code caller go first, and followed by the 410 area code caller. So greetings and welcome to Booker T. Washington Speaks. You've heard our preface, and we invite you to give your comments at this time, please.
Okay. Is this, am I on?
You are on. Yes, you are. Please, thank you for being
okay.
here.
Thank you. I haven't been on your show in a while. This is Brandy from Rockford, Illinois, joining
today. Dr. Brown, congratulations on your winning a seat on the Board of Education. We are so proud of you and so thrilled with your achievement, and we know that you're going to do well to represent the interests of all of the parents and other stakeholders, and especially the young students there in your area. And we just want to say congratulations.
Thank you so much. And probably since the last time we spoke, something has happened. All of a sudden, 16 days later after the vote, there was apparently a tie. And it was, this was something that I've been reading, a new fight. And I'm not on the board. We had to go through what you call a statue of tie break, either a coin toss or a card of decks. And we had to draw cards, and I ended up losing. I drew a lower card, and off the arbitrary, the county clerk decided to be the winner, but I did. I am going through a recount, a petition for a recount. But tonight's topic is definitely the agenda I'm on. I think I've always been on that, on keeping our history on the agenda, part of the curriculum, part of the talk, as well as that philosophy, teaching that philosophy to children, you know, helping them build self-determination, really positive self-images is what I would do as an educator and what I was planning on doing as a board member. But that I'm on a different fight now.
Well, first of all, let me say this. You know, we say in Islam that nothing happens except by the will of God, or we say in Arabic, Allah, Allah. And so what will be, but I certainly am happy that you had reached that point to where you were recognized at least for a time as being the person to occupy that seat. And if it turns out, you said you're asking for a recount, and if it turns out that it's God's will for you to have that seat, you'll have it. And if it's just a chance for you to reorient yourself and prepare for the next opportunity to do that, if you choose, then we definitely are backing you, and we will do everything that we can to support you. But as you say, you're on a different fight now, and we definitely want you to give us your thoughts on this topic tonight. Why have, in your opinion, why have African-American Muslims departed from the black nation-building agenda promoted by the Honorable Marcus Garvey? We also know that the Honorable Timothy Drew Ali and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and also secretly the Honorable Booker T. Washington, they promoted an agenda of helping our people to build self-sufficient or at least economically strong black communities. Some people don't like to use the word nation anymore, but they were actually thinking as the nationalists, they were building freedom for their people in Africa, were thinking. And so we see now that many men of the Muslims that were strongly involved will help with helping to develop wealth in our communities and other positive things have basically from that. So, Dr. Brown, what are your thoughts?
I think assimilation has a lot to do with that. I believe that, you know, the struggle to build your own business and go through the struggles of maybe for a period of time or maybe downsizing, you know, to sustain your own business or maybe having to borrow. You know, a lot of the times people don't want to struggle. And so many times, you know, I see it happen in our city of Rockford a lot, is that many will just lose their soul just to, you know, gain a position or try to, you know, join where they think is happening at. Even if that means giving up culture, giving up, lowering your beliefs and philosophy to for some money. And but I think it's a dissimulation philosophy instead of having more of a cultural base and going through the struggle of the struggles and the joint of having a business. And I think, and I do believe our dear ancestor Booker T. Washington was that model for that, building Tuskegee from the ground up, helping the people to visualize with him as well as building their self-determination and that turning that church into the school and then the church becoming the school and then new buildings were added to it. A lot of times some people just don't want to, or they're not proud of that culture. They're not proud of the hard work ethic and what it takes to build a business. That's kind of my view with why as sometimes people don't take on that, because you know I haven't read fully, but I do know like the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, even in one of his books, How to Eat to Live, you know, that's where food is where our energy comes from. Food can be medicine too. And sometimes that giving up is real hard to do. And again, for that giving up, it probably is a struggle for people. And just in my own view, I just think people don't want to struggle. They want to get, it's that microwave. They want it now instead of going through the struggle. And really where the struggle is, where your growth is at. And many times people just, like, it's just people don't want that. They don't, they want to disregard what Harriet tells us to join the truth, that thirst for freedom, and just figure out if I can, they'll accept working 9 to 5 in a white culture. In the white culture that's causing them high blood pressure.
Well, Dr. Brown, thank you so much for that insight, and we certainly appreciate it. We appreciate it, and we're going to ask you to come back on in a little while. We're going to give a few people a chance to make a response or give their own expressions. We have the caller from the 410 area code. The last two number digits are 62. We welcome you, and we would like for you to come on. If you would like to make a comment or several comments, it's your turn. Please come on at this time. It's your turn.
Yeah, assalamu alaikum, Brother Imam. This is Eric Pitney.
Your phone number, I recognize it.
Okay, great. really honored to be on the program, and I think your subject matter is very timely and critical. Hope it's not too late, really. But to respond to what you are asking, I don't think that we just lost our way haphazardly or spontaneously. I think there was a definite effort, a deliberate effort, a real counter effort to undermine the progress and the fulfillment of the nationalist progress that was being made. We definitely didn't lack leadership, as you just enumerated, starting with your great grandfather, who was not really known to history as a nationalist per se, but when you look at what he was doing and the way he was building institutions and promoting entrepreneurship and business, and the way all of that was practically playing out, we definitely had even the advice he was given for us to hold on to the land instead of migrating away from the land, which we know that there was a major migration from the south to the north and better opportunity, and ended up losing what we had. So and we see what history has done to his name. Basically, one of the greatest leaders of all time, just kind of dismissed by Black America as I don't know, maybe an Uncle Tom or a sellout. But Du Bois was given praise, and the whole Talented Tenth effort seemed to be, you know, the direction in which we went. Marcus Garvey was also undermined by that same Talented Tenth leadership. So, you know, a lot of the nationalists got undermined. Of course, J. Edgar Hoover, as we all know, was just coming into his own back during the time. I don't think it was during your great-grandfather's time, but definitely during the time of Marcus Garvey, and was, along with the Talented Tenth thrust, you know, led a campaign that Garvey must go, and Garvey ended up being deported. That was a major movement. So Elijah Muhammad, of course, built a financial economic empire, and shortly after his demise, that was undermined. So we have a lot of success stories. I mean, we know about Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. They were strong when the rest of the white America was not strong, and maybe even envied for that, and that was undermined. I think they were even bombed from the air during that whole famous infamous Tulsa riot. I think that there was deliberate attempts. In other words, we've had the success stories. We have, I mean, Madam C.J. Walker, we know about that. We had so many great economic success stories, and a sense of unity and nationhood, whether it been Noble Drew Ali and the Morris Science Temple and the promotion of Morris national identity. You know, we could go on and on and on. But it seems like every time we get to a place where we're in not only a good situation, but maybe sometimes often in a superior a situation, it seems like we're undermined. And I think what we're going through right now in this period is kind of like a post traumatic type of syndrome, because we had great leaders during the 60s. Malcolm X was assassinated. He was eliminated. Martin Luther King was eliminated. And I think I just don't see Elijah Muhammad passed away, of course. I think we're just kind of like in a post-traumatic situation. And like I said, we have trust issues, things like that. But we've been duped into abandoning the old nationalist tradition and spirit of economic development and whatnot that you're saying. What has happened that we no longer subscribe to those things? And I think the sister that spoke before me talked about assimilation as one thing. There's been a lot of efforts to integrate us, to assimilate us, to the extent that we've bought into that, and we no longer seek out our own identification, and we're almost like taught to not think that way, or that's inappropriate. and nothing could be more natural and appropriate. I don't know. There's a lot of psychological things going on, and I think that's where we're at right now. And I'm hoping that we can get back to reclaiming those traditions. We have great leaders like yourself that are still on the scene that are links to all of this. And I'm hoping that through programs like this and just us speaking out, letting people know that, you know, that reminding people of what, you know, some of us have forgotten, that we can get back to that spirit before it's too late. I hope I didn't say too much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
I hear you. I want to say thank you so much. We're so happy that you were willing to come on tonight and share your views, and I know you'll have more to say, and we're going to be looking forward to it very anxiously. At this time, I want to ask our co-host, Brother Halim Mustafa. I know that Brother Halim has some contribution to make. Okay, we've talked about this topic on a number of occasions. Brother Halim, take it away.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And again, good evening. Halim Mustafa here. I surmise what I heard in this one word or two words called social engineering. From the beginning, we were set up in slavery, and as a result of the social engineering, it has gotten more and more complicated, to the point that it utilizes religious orders as the basis to destroy our motivation, because we lose our self-identity tied into the idolatry of white supremacy. And anybody who are not white, no matter what their ethnic culture group, they become servants or what we call subservients of white supremacy through their practice of Christianity, with the white Jesus on the cross not depicting their own cultural identity. So we need to look at the success and failures of the black agenda. I know that's what our focus is in terms of the Muslims, but the black agenda in a general sense. And the idea that I see is that we have gotten to a point that we become kind of satisfied with progress, and the progress has been really not progress. It's been a reverse of progress. And I know about Black Wall Street very in-depthly, and certainly the ideas of what was the other. We had Rosewood was a very dynamic community growing, and we had in Northern California, the Nation of Islam growing very vibrantly. Now, I wasn't a part of that first movement. I was quite scared of the Muslims. They were kind of really strong-minded, and I was like, really, wow, these guys are so strong. I'm afraid to get in the circle. But after a while, you realize that Elijah Muhammad prepared us for not war with anyone, but war with ourselves, to actually challenge ourselves. And I think we've lost that spirit today. I hear a lot of the leaders talking from the various religious institutes of African American people, and it's not actually they're talking about it from a level of extending credibility to the leaders that have come before, but taking the leadership of their own what you call blowing your own whistle to say that you're the greatest in the West or the greatest in the world, and that's the problem today. The leadership has to acknowledge the past and not try to take credit for themselves as being contributors, because history will bear that fact. Don't try to make your history on the back of other folks, like Dr. King, not him, but Jesse Jackson, as example of taking leadership from, say, the blood of Dr. King and saying that he was chosen as the next leader. So I'm going to kind of relax myself at the moment here and just kind of chime in here, but I'm loud and clear hearing everything being discussed.
Well, great. Okay, well, that's very good, and we certainly want you to continue. I know that you and I have talked, and we have made a pact, you might say, that we will let our guests dominate the conversation, but we certainly welcome you as our co-host to come in at any point to either expand on what the other speakers have said or to introduce something else that may be needed. But I want to share something quite quickly from a book which is a compilation of transcripts of speeches that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad gave during the summer of 1972. I happen to have been present for one of those speeches. But the one that I am going to read now was not one of those that I, or the one that I attended, but he said this. He said, "We're trying to make you see the importance of us doing something for self. I have, with the help of Allah being the Arabic word for God, the God, I have, with the help of Allah, believers who follow me, or bring to you an example of people who want to do something for self. And if you are qualified to help us, come in and help. We will greatly appreciate your help and pray to Allah." But Halim, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Loud and clear, loud and clear, loud and clear, sir.
Okay, we will greatly appreciate your help and pray to Allah to give you the quality if you don't have what's needed to join up with us. We learned of some of our people who are qualified to help build. We're coming after you. You're not rejected, nor anyone else. We just want the people who can build according to the blueprint we give them. If you cannot build according to the blueprint, don't accept the job because you hurt your reputation with your own people. We don't want you cast out of the job that we could have the money borrowed to have done. Confess what you can do. Don't tell us what you cannot do. We're glad if you can do it, but don't accept a job if you know you can't do it just because you are our brother. Just say, "Brother, I'm your brother, but I can't do this job." Then we will know what to do. But don't take a job from us knowing you're not qualified to do it. That hurts you and us. We want to admire your ability to do the job. I'm so happy to learn that we have people among us who can do anything. We have some wise and well-trained people, but they never were able to get together. And this is a key point. I'll stop on this note. We have some wise and well-trained people, but they never were able to get together and do something for self. I want them to get with me, and I'll show them some places where they can go to work and do something for self. To leave such great people sitting idly by, just listening to thoughts, and I'll add to that expansive flowery speeches, and never materializing the thought, it's not good. Get these people that have the know-how to work and let them do the work. And so we're going to stop right there. But I wanted to share that with you because of the fact that my particular opinion, very briefly stated, is that there has been a movement, an insidious, sneaky, and deceitful movement of some alien forces to come among our African American, and I know our brother that just spoke prefers another name for our people, Moorish people, and I can definitely agree with that because I have been to Morocco and I've seen brothers that look just like me, and so I definitely can accept that. But the common term that we have been hearing for the last 30 years for our people has been African American, so you'll hear me use that quite a bit, but I definitely concur with our brother. The fact is, we've had these forces come among us to divide us ways that we didn't even see coming, to position us against each other with religious ideologies that supposedly were supposed to bring us together, but actually divided us. And by that, I mean, for example, there are some people that like to pray in the Muslim tradition in one form. They fold their hands across their midsection, or the women raise their hands higher. But Then there are others who like to pray with their arms by their sides, and something like this, believe it or not, will cause people that may have skills that if they were to work together could establish a small industry. But because of something like that, that somebody came in and said, if you don't pray with your hands like this, God is not going to accept your prayer. You have to pray with your hands like that. And we've gotten caught up in all of these divisive, what I would say, interpretations of what God wants. And that really is something that we need to deal with. We have to come to some common terms to understand that God wants us to get over our baby theology of these things are more important than us working together to build schools and mosques or even churches for the Christians, and to work together. And we can work out these other things, but not let these other divisions keep us from building teams to clean up our communities, to police our communities and educate our children, to take care of our old people, to take care of the health problems of people that can't afford to pay some of the big doctor bills that the hospitals and doctors charge. We have doctors in our community, and I've known people that did this, that went down into the ghetto and set up free clinics to provide services. But we won't be able to succeed doing this if we get hung up in all of these, and I won't call them trivialities, they're not trivialities, but things that are not the most important things we need to look at. So that's my comment for now. So we're going to go back, and that's our brother that is, again, since you didn't announce your name, and I won't either, but if you want to, that's wonderful. But our brother from the 779 area code, last two digits of 55, if you would like to further comment on what you began to talk about or what Brother Halim or myself or Dr. Brown said. Are you there, our brother from 779, our brother from the Moore Science Temple?
No, I'm not with the Morris Science Temple, but I just subscribe to the Morris National Identity. Morris Science Temple, no Budrali. It's a common common thing. I just think that that No Budrali was one of the illustrious forefathers that we had that did very much to promote that lost awareness, and it's interesting that you say that, because I want people to understand really that this is not a contemporary identity or movement. This is a movement as far as us here in America that goes all the way back to the founding of the Republic itself. Morocco, as you spoke about later, and Moor does not just mean one that's from the country of Morocco or Mauritania. It pertains to all of our people in northern and throughout Western Africa are collectively known as Moors, various types of Moors, and I'll get into that later. But it goes back to the founding of this country, of the Republic, and the first government to recognize the independence of the United States from England was the Morocco. The Sultan of Morocco was the first to recognize the United States, and not only recognized the United States independence, but also provided financing for the startup of the nation. So, it goes all the way back to the root. The Moroccan government and its recognition and its support gave formation to the United States Republic. There would be no United States Republic without that. And in treating with the new country, Morocco also had a alliance with England prior to United States. So there was an alliance there that even goes back to the early history of the colonies here. And then when they broke and got independence, a new treaty was formed with the independent colonies, you know, that became the United States. So, yeah. So, and in that treaty, which preceded the Constitution, preceded the election of George Washington, like I said, just gave formation to all of this. In that treaty, it refers to our people as Moors. I mean, this is the supreme law of the land, and that's how we're recognized as Moors, not as black people, not as African Americans, not as Negroes or colored people or anything else, but as Moors. And under that law, we were to be protected in our rights and in our ability to exist and practice our faith. And it's also interesting that the term Moor in the treaty is in English. The treaty is in both the Arabic language and the English language. In the English language, we're referred to as Moors, but in the Arabic language, those Moors are referred to as Muslims. So, you know, it's very interesting that the term Moor and Muslim are synonymous at law. So, I mean, if we really want to come up with a lawful identity, one that can recognize us, that goes back to the founding, and it's not a European term. I mean, this is something that is recognized by our forefathers. So anyway, just wanted to say that say all of that just to say that, you know, it didn't start with in 1913 with Noble Drawley. This is not a contemporary movement. After the treaty was established in 1787. The recognition of the United States started in 1777. The treaty was finally established in 1787. And right upon that, in 1789, the Constitution was established. And right after that, we had some of our ancestors who were enslaved. And they were able to petition the Congress and have themselves recognized as being protected under the treaty. So they were called this was called the Sundry Free Moors Act, and about there was a few Moorish a few Moorish people that were captured and enslaved, and they were able to petition and regain their freedom on behalf of themselves and others who were, you know, affiliated with them. But that's a long history that I won't be able to get into. And then, of course, some of your listeners might be familiar with the great West African emir who was enslaved, named Abdulrahman ibn Suri. He was enslaved in 1778. You know, right after this whole all of this was taking place, he was enslaved. He was from Fouta Djallon, I think it was from Senegal. He was from a royal family there, and once word got back to Morocco that he was enslaved, the Sultan of Morocco demanded his release, and he was ultimately released once it was found out that he was there, and the treaty was instrumental in that. So I say all of that just to say that there's some really solid history and law behind nationality and the nationalist movement and Islam, and these things are not in conflict with each other. In fact, in America, they're synonymous with each other. Islam and nationality is synonymous with each other. So we have brothers and sisters today who are waking up to this, and we're starting to come together, and we have the spirit of those great, illustrious forefathers that most of us know, Marcus Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, Noble Drawley, Malcolm X, you know, the Honorable Booker T. Washington. And I mean, all of that spirit is with us, but now we're coming into some real solid history, even about these men and their background. But we're coming into some real solid history as to what all of this is lawfully recognized under. And when we bring that spirit together under that history and law, then we're a force that cannot be denied. And I'm hoping that more and more brothers and sisters will wake up to this that's when we're going to see the Islam and the national identity and, you know, the avoidance of extremism on any of those counts. You know, we can have religious extremism, and we can also have a racial and national extremism. And hopefully, you know, the key to all of this is balancing the two, and that's where the power is, and that's where the authority is. And may Allah bless us to realize that. I'm done. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I guess you were on mute. I hope I got through. I don't know if everything I said got through or not.
It did.
Okay, great. If I said anything.
Okay. Yeah. All right, can you hear me?
I can hear you clear now. I don't know if you were speaking before.
Yeah,
or not.
Okay. Well, that's a little technical thing that I'm trying to work out on this end at the studio. But we're good now. And I just want to say thank you. And we certainly are learning a lot from you every time that we converse in the past over the last few days, or even especially tonight, some of the history. But we want to continue because there's so much more that we can learn from each other. So I'm going to ask Dr. Brown if you would come back with us and give us your thoughts on the things that we've discussed so far.
A lot of the information the brother was just sharing is new information for me, as well the history of Morocco and hearing about the person that was released from slavery, that was from the Senegal, the royalty that was released. But I think that just goes back to show, you know, how important education is, as well as the unity factor that needs to exist within our community, that regardless, we all come from a common historic background that is rich, and it's something that we need to share with each other. And this is our African history is the crucial piece that is missing from the education system daily. Again, in our school systems, many of the teachers and, you know, studies show 93% of our teachers in the United States are white. They don't know this history. And so this also has to do with that this disproportionate number of African-American students who are receiving, you know, that colonial history daily, and it's creating a lot of that self-hatred, or not the self-motivation to want to know about it until, you know, coming across somebody relevant that knows this history and is patient to share it with children or with adults. And but I do think that education piece is crucial. That's going to help and build our future generations, because if they receive it now, or just when they do receive it, that's just where the positive self-images, as well as the self-motivation to want to learn and create a new identity, it's that self-determination. It helps to make that more possible. But I myself was learning that new treaty that was I wrote down those dates, so you know that's my homework for the week to look at. But again, I just like to share with the audience as well that I just think the education part and our and history is just more important, that it needs to continue to be shared, because it's not shared within our school system, and many of the teachers don't know this rich information. Thank you.
Are we still on the air?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. All right, can you hear me? This is Eric.
I can hear you.
Yeah, I don't hear the brother Imam, though.
Oh.
I don't.
Who was that person you stated earlier? Amir? What was Amir's?
He's a very famous.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
In African. I'm sorry. There he is.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
There he is,
that,
brother.
I'm doing a little technical thing here, and I'm working with two different pieces of equipment, but I think it's good now. Can y'all hear me now?
Yes, sir.
I can hear you perfectly. Yes.
Okay.
Loud and clear.
All right. Let me go ahead and share something with you, and then we're going to go ahead and we're going to continue. I thought that our co-host was on the line, but he dropped off for a minute, but he'll be back. He just came back, as a matter of fact. So after I read this, I'm going to ask him to speak. But this is a poem that speaks to what we've just been discussing. What I began to say, though, before I read the poem, is that this poem appears in a volume, a very thick book of 1,034 pages. And the title of it is African American Literature. And it is filled with powerful contributions from people that we should be familiar with. For example, Benjamin Banneker, his letter to Thomas Jefferson, Phyllis Wheatley on being brought from Africa to America, Sojourner Truth, Ain't I a Woman? Frederick Douglass, from the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. And, of course, Ida B. Wells, from Crusade for Justice, W.E.B. Du Bois, The Song of the Smoke, Paul Laurence Dunbar, We Wear the Mask, and Booker T. Washington, from Up from Slavery, and Langston Hughes, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. And I won't go into all of the names, but we have Richard Wright and Margaret Walker, who is the author of the poem I'm going to read. We also have James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And it just goes on and on. But the point is that when I spoke at this black high school in February of last year to the senior class, the teacher came to me after the students had returned to their classrooms, because we met in the library area, and she gave me this book and she said, "I saved this book for you." Sort of struck me as being mildly disconcerting, because I was asking myself, why did she have to save a book for me? I mean, she could have just said that here's a book that I want to give you as a gift, but she made a point of the fact that she saved it. And so I asked her, I said, "Excuse me, but what do you mean you saved it?" She said, "The Board of Education told us to pack those books up and remove them from the school." Now, that struck me as being draconian. I'm saying, you mean that the people that run the school system don't want our children to read the expressions urging our people to have faith and hope in America that we can have freedom, true freedom, justice, and equality? And yet they now see that this book is, in their opinion, irrelevant to our, as you said earlier, assimilation. And yet, without belaboring the point, I saw on television today on the public TV station that I am able to access here, a whole town full of Cambodian people, recent immigrants to America, that it has its social problems, but it's a community unto itself. They have their own businesses, their own schools, their own churches. They have their own social life, their own cultural life. And yet, as we are being taught by leaders like the ones that I mentioned and others, now they're saying we shouldn't have access to the kind of information that would pull us together to have that. And I ask myself, what is going on here? But let me just read this, and I'll pass it on to our co-host. This is Margaret Walker. She also wrote a very, very important book 50 years ago entitled Jubilee, which is a story of a family that went from slavery up through the Reconstruction and up to real, you know, success as a family, but still suffered many trials. Margaret Walker. And she says in this poem called Lineage, and I'll read it, "My grandmothers were strong. They followed plows and bent to toil. They moved through fields sowing seed. They touched earth and grew, and grain grew. And they were full of sturdiness and singing. Oh, my grandmothers were strong. My grandmothers are full of memories, smelling of soap and onions and wet clay, with veins rolling roughly over quick hands. They have many clean words to say. My grandmothers were strong. Why am I not as they?" So that's powerful. And we know that our young women, unfortunately, that doesn't include them all, but many of our young women just don't have that strength. They don't have that character that our grandparents and great-grandparents and even our mothers in many cases had. And we have to ask ourselves, what has happened in terms of the home training and the educational system that has divided our people from our true self and deprived us of that strength, which I call nationhood. Now, there are many terms we can use, but nation is related to nature, which is related to nurture, which is related to the word nativity, which means to be born. And we were born with an innate sense of wanting to be who God wanted us to be, which is strong people. And some people used to say, back in the 70s, strong black man, strong black woman. But what has happened is that we are losing that in the religious sense. As I said, we had a movement, and I was in it. I came in towards the end, but I came in the Nation of Islam in 1969, remained under the Honorable Elijah Muhammad until he passed in 1975, and then made the transition to the leadership of his son, Wallace D. Muhammad. But I can tell you right now, that the strength that we had during the time the Honorable Elijah Muhammad held us together, we don't have anymore. We know a lot more about the religion of Islam than we did, but we don't have that strength. We don't have that unity. And we can talk about that in another program, because I like to get more of the people that went through the Nation of Islam to come on. But I just wanted tonight to talk in general about our community. It doesn't necessarily have to reflect on the African-American Muslims, but why is our community departing from those tenets that made us a strong community? Our brother, Haleem Mustafa, mentioned Rosewood. I happened to have met one of the women who was a Rosewood survivor several years ago. She was living in Florida. I don't know if she's still alive because she was quite old at the time. I think she was almost 100 years old, and this was 15, 16 years ago. But I happened to visit her in her apartment in the senior citizen's home down in West Palm Beach, Florida. And she was, I guess you could say, secreted out of Rosewood the night before the big attack on the black community of Rosewood. But that, from what I saw in the movie, was a very thriving community, just like Mount Bayou in Mississippi. And really, sadly to say, just like Tuskegee was back in the day when I was growing up. It's not like it used to be. Something has happened to our people that we are not able to stand up and shake off the attacks and build again and keep going forward. But look at the Jewish people who suffered the tragedy, the atrocity of the Holocaust. And I have to say that I believe it happened because I've seen movies with the bodies, the bones, the skeletal corpses, and it convinced me that this was a reality. But yet, look how they have achieved prominence. I was just saying today that Hollywood is basically owned by the Jews, and yet Hollywood affects almost everybody, whether it's on TV, on the internet, movies, or whether it's in the theaters. What they put out in Hollywood basically makes the culture be what it is from year to year. So they were able to come back together because they never separated, even though they went through that. So enough of my talk, but I want to ask our brother, Halim, as we get towards the close of our conversation. We have some more time, but once we've exhausted what we have to say, I'm going to close it. Brother Halim, how would you like to respond to the things you've heard so far?
Well, I want to say thank you again. I'll go back to the term social engineering, which is a new term for mind manipulation at all levels of human development. Now, I know in history, the garbage chef named as Gorbachev in Russia, he made comment to America. He said that, you know, we have in Soviet Union a way of mind control, but you in America have a system that's more sophisticated than ours. Now, keep in mind that this social engineering is a science, right? They've analyzed how to manipulate people out of the understanding of who was the first human beings on Earth, and they use all this imagery for such purposes. But I want to say also, too, we get stuck as a people. We get stuck in the past all the time. And I get kind of frustrated hearing us always get stuck in the past, stuck in the past, stuck in the past, and we never go to the future with new leadership development. I believe our leader, illustrious leader, Imam Morsi Muhammad, was talking about futuristic vision, futuristic achievement. And we always go back to the past, and we get stuck in the past, and we get argumented in the past instead of taking what we learned in the past as a lesson and move forward to the future with what is a combination of everything that we have to do, right? But people have gotten, I believe this might be an idea that we're becoming self-glorious in our conversation instead of doing the work that's going to change the nation. We got to do the work. We can't be the talk, right? Because that's too much talk already, and that's the problem. So, and I just want to say that the idea of every culture, every other culture feeds off their historical ancestors. I understand that. And we need to do that as well, but we don't need to get stuck just in defining the history of it to a finite point that becomes our only conversation. And so I'm going to stop right there right now. That's my comments for now. I'll listen up and then further comment later.
Well, that's good. I want to mention something. I'm looking in a book that is actually a pictorial history of Tuskegee Institute. Now it's Tuskegee University, and there's a picture of the chapel that I attended when I was a child, and I wasn't fortunate enough to have attended the chapel services there as a college student because it was mysteriously burned to the ground in my last year of elementary school. I watched it burn, and that was a tragic sight. And, of course, the suspicion was that some white supremacists had burned it down because it was during the height of the Montgomery boycott, bus boycott, and also a boycott in Tuskegee against some of the white businesses that had allied themselves to work to keep black people from having the municipal vote. It was never proven by the fire marshal. Of course, he was one of them, and maybe he was told not to give a fair assessment of how the fire started, but we all felt that some white supremacists had done it because a week before that happened, a Ku Klux Klan cross was burned a few yards away from the chapel. So that was pretty clear to us what most likely happened. But what I really want to mention on the good side is that I'm also looking at a picture of Robert Robinson Taylor, who was a contemporary of Booker T. Washington. He was about 10 years younger than Booker T. Washington. And it says in the script underneath his picture that he, first of all, was the first black graduate of Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But he was recruited by Booker T. Washington while he was still going to school there. Booker T. Washington made many trips to Boston and to that area. He had many benefactors in that area. And somehow or another, he managed to be introduced to this up-and-coming young African-American architect. Architecture student, and he recruited him. to come to Tuskegee. And he was the one that designed many of the buildings, almost all of the buildings that were built in Booker T. Washington's time. And the campus of Tuskegee was proclaimed to be the most beautiful college campus in the state of Alabama. And that's not the most beautiful black college campus, but the most beautiful college campus of all of the schools in Alabama. And Robert Russell Moton was the architect. Now, I mention that to say that the power that is in the minds of our people, whether they have college educations or whether they were craftsmen like Booker T. Washington, who learned something of the building trades at Hampton, but his main job that he learned was janitorial work. And working in the janitorial field, he learned not just about how to clean the buildings, but he learned to observe the aesthetic beauty architecturally of the building. So he was a person that had a vision from the time he was 16 years old of the kind of environment that he knew our people should be educated in. And Tuskegee was not a college during his tenure. It was basically what we would call a prep school on a secondary education level. But yet he produced students that graduated there with skills to go out and be teachers and also community leaders and builders of communities. And my point is this: there's a spirit that has been lacking ever since the 60s. I was a child of the Black Revolution of the 60s. I went to college at Tuskegee right in the middle of the Black Revolution. I saw Malcolm and heard Malcolm X speak at Tuskegee in February of 1965, 3 weeks before he was killed. And certainly during that time, we had every reason to protest. But the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us that the protesting was not going to free us. And has it freed us? No, it hasn't. But he said that if we build an economic powerhouse so strong that the white people are dependent upon us for their own well-being, they will invite us to the table. So where are we right now? Are we working on that, or are we moving backwards? That's a good question. I want to invite your opinions. We're going to close in a few minutes, but I definitely want to invite our brother from the 779 area code, last two digits of 55. Brother, please come on again and let us hear what your thoughts are.
Yes, are you speaking with me?
Yes, I'm speaking about you. Please come back and you were able to hear about Dad, please give us some comments.
The phone number that you rattled off did not match mine, but I thought you were talking about me, and you were. So, just to respond to you, I agree with the protest answer that you gave. I think that we need to be more focused on building than reacting. I wanted to respond to something earlier, though. I think that history is definitely critical. You being a historian yourself, and appreciate that. I think that as you were taught, and as I agree, that history of all studies, history is most qualified to reward our research. And at the same time, I believe that there has to be a balance struck between the study of history and its translation into institution building and law. That's the point that I was trying to make when I was going back in history and talking about the foundational law and establishment of things. If you don't have a foundation, if you don't have a paradigm, then your nation could very well be built on sand, and I want my nation to be built on a rock, and that's something that can't be denied or taken away from you. We were talking about some of the success stories earlier. Economically, we have many We had numerous success stories that were ultimately undermined, and, you know, we had to start all over again. And even with the great leaders that you talked about, they all were success stories. But in the end, you know, maybe Booker T. Washington is the only one that still has a major institution that is, you know, still thriving today. So, I think that we need to build and be constructive. I think we need to, you know, have a solid grounding in history and a history that translates into law, because history if it doesn't exist in law, it really doesn't exist. And at best, it just becomes like a ego boost at best. So, I don't have much else to say about it. Just, you know, I think my thing is that everything has to be balanced. We talked about religion earlier, and we talked about nationality and nationhood, and how those two things have to come together. I find a lot of people that are nationalists that have very little regard for religion, and kind of like you know, kind of like have a very dismissive attitude towards it. And I see a lot of religionists who have very little regard for nationhood and nationality, and almost see it as something that is a distraction from religiosity. So I'm just hoping that, you know, all nations, when we study the foundations of great nations, they all have a sacred cornerstone and order that they're established on. So, and at the same time, you know, we need both spirit and nationhood. So I'll just leave it at that before I start to babble.
Okay, well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for all of the things you've contributed tonight. We're going to close in just a minute, but I want to go around one more time. And I want to ask Dr. Brown, would you like to make another contribution as we prepare to close out?
I definitely thank you for bringing up Booker Washington's architect skill that he had, which I agree is he carried that to building Tuskegee, this legacy that is left. But that chapel you were talking about that later got burned, and I think I think the brother was saying too, you know, when we make that progress and then it gets burned, but, you know, that building might be gone or that place might be gone, but those memories are still there. Those memories are still kept alive, and those are the things I think that are important that needs to be written in that history, in the books. Not just of Tuskegee, but in the books. This is what happened in Alabama. This Rosewood is where all this happened, and having these survivors, these memories are important. That way, people of today are able to again hold, like, okay, this did happen, and what am I going to do? Make sure it doesn't happen again, and speaking out about it. But I appreciate hearing that.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to make one more final quotation. This is from Booker T. Washington's book, and then I'm going to let Brother Halim Mustafa give the last commentary, and then we'll be closing out. But Booker T. Washington in Up From Slavery talks about the period right after the end of chattel slavery called Reconstruction. And, of course, Reconstruction meant the reconstructing of the South as a part of the federal union. But the fact is that the African-American people weren't reconstructed, because they would have had to have been given back what was robbed from them when they were brought to the islands in the Caribbean to be seasoned by people who had been trained to break their spirit as free people and make them see themselves as slaves. And I happen to have lived on one of those islands for a year in the Bahamas. Most of the slave breaking took place in places like Barbados, but I could see the effects of that same kind of slave making in the island of Eleuthera in the Bahamas. The people there were forced to raise pineapples for the overseas export. And you can see, just as you look in the faces of the people, they don't have the same look of dignity and pride, but now they have a lot of dignity in the Bahamas. But you can see that something has happened to those people when you compare them with some of the people that I actually met from Africa that did not go through that kind of experience. But the reconstruction is still happening for us. It has not really happened yet. It's beginning to move as we begin to understand what has occurred that degraded us and broke us apart. But Booker T. Washington says in the book From Slavery, quote, during the whole of the Reconstruction period, our people throughout the South looked to the federal government for everything. Isn't that familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Very much as a child looks to its mother. This was not unnatural. The central government gave them freedom, and the whole nation has been enriched for more than two centuries by the labor of the Negro. Then he continues, even as a youth and later in manhood, I had the feeling that it was cruelly wrong in the central government at the beginning of our freedom to fail to make some provision for the general education of our people in addition to what the states might do so that the people would be better prepared for the duties of citizenship. And I'll just mention this. It's not in the quotation, but I'll just mention this. Well, I will say this from the quotation. Actually, it says, since as I look back now, the entire period of our freedom, I cannot help feeling that it would have been wiser if some plan could have been put in operation, which would have made the possession of a certain amount of education or property or both a test for the exercise of the franchise. Now, many people criticize Booker T. Washington harshly because he did not push or fight, as some people have said. He didn't fight for the franchise for our people. But see, Booker T. Washington had the vote. He had the vote. He could go downtown and vote. Why were they letting him go downtown and vote? Because they had a certain standard, and all he said was that we can meet that standard, but you should apply that same standard to your people. If they're ignorant, if they can't read the Constitution, if they don't understand the essential meaning of what it means to be a citizen of a community, don't let them vote. If you're not going to let us vote, but those people who measure up to those standards, you should not restrict them from voting. And what he was doing was he was preparing our people so that we would not be excused because we didn't measure up. Now, we know even the most educated of our people were not able to vote. And when our people did show in the 50s when I was a child in Tuskegee, that they had measured up to all the standards, then what the community of white people in Tuskegee did is they went to the legislature, and the legislature, at the request of the white people, redrew the lines of the municipality of Tuskegee to exclude those neighborhoods where all of the educated white people lived. And, of course, later that was overturned by the Supreme Court. But the point is that we have the vote. But when we have the opportunity to elect representatives that would help to empower the president, people say, well, he didn't do much. But black people certainly couldn't do much if he had a Congress that voted down everything he tried to do. How many times, we don't know, but how many times did he send his representatives to Congress to talk to the leadership to try to get something moving that would have helped us, and he was rebuffed many times, I'm sure. Because I just recently saw a movie about young Obama when he was a young lawyer working in Chicago. And if this movie is true, and I see no reason why it wouldn't be, he was very passionately concerned about elevating black people. He didn't have to leave Harvard in the summertime and go to the south side of Chicago to become a community organizer. But he cared about black people even after the president. Obama had his position, but he wasn't able because we did not meet the qualification of having the passion to exercise that right that we fought so hard for. So I just want to end on that note, going back to our original topic. Can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? The topic really had to do with African-American Muslims departing from the nation-building agenda, but I'm going to take this and put it in another context. Take out African-American Muslims, because that gets into a whole different conversation that we're not having tonight, which has to do with a lot of theological and cultural issues that pertain to the people that were in the Nation of Islam. And we won't talk about that until we get some of their representatives here. But the fact is, if we just say, why have many African-Americans departed from the black nation building agenda, I think that we've covered that. I mean, there's many reasons. The assimilation, the fact that our people have been basically cut off from, as Dr. Brown said, from the passion to achieve and become comfortable with whatever we got from being 9-to-5 employees, just so we could get credit to get a car, in many cases a nice home, and a safe job, as we used to think of these jobs in academia as being safe, but they're no longer safe. I work in academia, and I can truthfully say that most of these tenured professors now are even afraid that they may not be there as long as they thought, because now they have the 5-year review. Didn't used to have that. You can have tenure now, and if during the 5-year review they find that you're deficient, what they will do in the state of Georgia is put you on a remedial track to get back to where you meet their standards. And if you don't fulfill what you agree to do in that remedial track, they will find cause to let you go. So there's no more job security anymore. But that 9-to-5 used to represent a false sense of security, and it took away from us our drive to do something for ourselves. So I'll end on that note. And I'll turn it over for the last comment from my brother, Mustafa, Dr. Holly Mustafa. Brother Dr. Holly Mustafa, it's all you.
Yes, yes. Good evening again. I want to say in a consolidated way that past, the present, and the future that is embodied in what Dr. Booker Washington represents and what he did historically to bring Dr. George Washington Carver to help him build Tuskegee Institute. Now, in terms of what I'm referencing Dr. Carver, he was the first African-American to ever receive a federal holiday in his country's history and the first and only American scientist to receive such distinction under a federal law called Public Law 290, passed in 1945 by the 79th U.S. Congress and signed and mandated by President Harry S. Truman, mandating that all federal buildings fly flags in half staff in honor of Dr. George Washington Carver. And as a result of such information as I came in contact with, which is in the historical records and encyclopedias, World Book and Collier, and certainly the federal law that I referenced to you, Public Law 290, we were able to put together a K-12 educational program called the Carver Scholars Program that became the model for the country that is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. So we here in California, under my leadership, not egotistical speaking, but the fact that I had the information provided to me by Dr. Fatima Ali of this day, of Dr. Carver, but no one in the whole country was doing anything about it. I contacted Tuskegee University. I contacted Carver Museum, and they knew nothing of it. So I initiated a campaign from East Palo Alto, California, where I'm at right now, outside enjoying this beautiful city that is now under gentrification, being taken over by white supremacy money. But the point is this, that Dr. Booker T. Washington and Dr. George Washington Carver were embody of the past, present, and future. And the evidence of that fact is that Dr. Carver was given a federal holiday, and he was told by the president of Ames Iowa University, when he received a letter from Dr. Booker T. Washington, he asked the president of Ames Iowa to give his opinion, and the man told him specifically that we at Ames Iowa offer you fame and fortune, but Dr. Booker T. Washington offers you immortality. Go and God be with you. And the immortality is this law that I told you about, this federal holiday, and the responsibility that he took on with Dr. Booker T. Washington. He actually had him. He stayed with him even after he had passed. And he stayed another extra 40 years or so. But the point is that he was committed to the vision that Dr. Booker T. Washington laid out as the founder of Tuskegee. And so the two of them pioneered a very marvelous journey, and we have to follow that suit. And we have a telethon being planned right now to address the issue, and we've done this for the last 10 years, and we're embodying it now, and we're asking for a Nobel Peace Prize posthumously from the Nobel Foundation, who ignored communication from myself regarding such a distinction. So that's my comments. I know it might have been a little bit sideways, but it's all about the truth and reality of what is the historical federal holiday given to Dr. George Washington Carver, who was known as the Wizard of Tuskegee, and that's my comments.
Well, we certainly welcome that. I grew up in Tuskegee. I visited the Carver Museum many, 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 many times. As a matter of fact, I spoke there about a year and a half ago, and I've always been inspired ever since I was a little boy by Dr. George Washington Carver, and he definitely fits into the paradigm of our people in the nation-building agenda. He wasn't a person that was known for being politically oriented or politically motivated, but when you think of the fact that he devoted his life from that time that he was a young man until he died in 1943, that he gave his whole life to trying to prepare black farmers and students that were going to school, studying agriculture and studying science, to become economically powerful instead of being tenant farmers and sharecroppers in terms of the main kind of work that they were given to do, which was basically neo-slavery on the plantations where their grandfathers and great-grandfathers, and during his early years, even maybe some of their fathers, had worked as chattel slaves. He was definitely about building a consciousness of being free. And so that's part of the nation building paradigm. So we thank you, Brother Dr. Holly Mustafa. So we're going to close now. If no one else has any comments to make, I don't want to cut anybody off that has a thought right on the tip of your tongue. So if you do have something to say, please let us hear it now, and we'll give you time to do it. We have time, but if you don't, we'll go ahead and play some nice interlude of music as we close out. So does anybody have any final words they want to say?
I just want to thank you for having me on this, allowing me to be on this program, and it's such a important topic, and I hope that it will become a series, an ongoing series, because it's definitely not something that can be, dealt with in one segment.
Well, we do definitely going to come back to this. There's many things that we haven't discussed. There are many things, pardon me, that we haven't discussed pertaining to this general topic of African-Americans, or more, as you would say, in general having departed from those concepts and those visions of the great men. I mentioned some. There are many others. Frederick Douglass is another. We didn't mention him. But he definitely was in the same vein as Marcus Garvey. He was one of the original people that stood up and demanded that we become not only free politically or legally, but that we become free economically. We'll talk about him in a program at another time. But thank you very much, our dear brother. We hope that we continue this conversation between the two of us. But for all of you who have joined us tonight, we really appreciate you. We thank you. We love you. And God bless you. We hope that you'll enjoy the rest of the weekend. And keep us in mind as you talk to your friends, relatives, and associates, and let them know about this program. We want it to be a family room discussion that includes everyone, even people out of our immediate family. I call it our extended family of people that are not in our ethnicity, but that are humans, and that's part of our family. So you can invite anybody because we all can share our thoughts. Thank you. May God bless you, and good night. And if you want to stay tuned and listen to the soft music, fine, but we're going to be signing off in just a second.